You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Despite the political divides and heated debate over Donald Trump's first 12 days in office, the United States seems calm compared to some countries. Turkey, a critically important NATO ally since 1952, has suffered a wave of terrorist attacks, an attempted coup, and growing restrictions on political opposition. The kind of activism we saw at JFK Airport last week has become a commonplace in Turkey. In Under the Shadow, Rage and Revolution in Modern Turkey, novelist and essayist Kaya Genç talks with artists, authors, journalists, and others across Turkey's political spectrum. His book is published by IB Taurus, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Kaya Genç to our show today. Hello.
Hello. It's great to be here.
Before we get into your book, what's been the general reaction in Turkey to President Trump's executive order on refugees and immigrants?
People had high hopes from Mr. Trump in Turkey, especially the Turkish government. They were happy to see that he was elected. And Mr. Erdogan's line was that Trump would change much of the policies he promised once he got into the office. And I think the Muslim ban was one of these things that he hoped Mr. Trump wouldn't impose. But after he imposed it, of course, there was a big reaction. And in conservative papers, you started seeing critical articles about Trump and big pieces about the demonstrations here.
Turkey is not among the seven countries that were named in his executive order. Did you have any problems getting into the United States?
My publisher was concerned. They asked me if they could be of help. If something happens, they gave me numbers to call, but nothing happened because we're not on the list, but we can be on that list anytime, you know.
According to the United States Census Bureau, there are over 200,000 Turks living in this country, including some well-known ones, Dr. Oz, Muhtar Kent, the CEO of Coca-Cola. Did any of the people you interviewed for the book have friends or family here?
Yeah, they are mostly middle-class Turks. I've interviewed mostly urban middle-class Turks, whether they are conservative or secular. And so they have family in Europe and the U.S. And so I think they would share the same kind of concerns that we are having at the moment.
The subtitle of your book is Rage and Revolution in Modern Turkey. What's the revolution that your title suggests?
It's a revolution of opinion. It began in 2013. Before 2013, Turkey was a relatively calm country where it was seen as a liberal country. But in my book, I argue that it was most illiberal when it was represented as its most liberal self. There was a problem of articulation. Young people were not able to articulate themselves before 2013. And so this revolution was one of freedom of expression. People started suddenly to express themselves, articulate themselves in such a way that they get addicted to it, and that became a kind of revolution in the political discourse.
When Erdogan became a political power way before 2013, there were concerns about the fact that he was an Islamist in a country that had this very strong secular history. Has Turkey gotten past that?
I think the main concern was that he was too involved with Europe. Actually, the main opposition in Turkey against Erdogan was saying that you are the man of Brussels, you are the man of European Union, you are the man of Washington. People said that Erdogan was sent from Washington to Turkey to rule the country and to make it a moderate Islamic state. So the main criticism...
I don't think anybody in this country sees it that way.
Yeah, but the secular opposition in Turkey, that was their main point. And the fact that he was pushing for a pro-EU agenda, that they didn't like. We didn't want to lose sovereignty. That's the main opposition line. So all that changed after 2013. But the main concern was with Erdogan's neoliberalism and pro-EU liberalism, more than his Islamism. Before 2013, I think that's an important point.
there were rumors of military coups all along, and then the military did try to overthrow the government in last July. How much support for the military was there among the general population?
Generally, the support for the military is very high because people see it as a guardian of Republican values and secularism. But
going all the way back to Kemal Ataturk.
Yeah, all the way to 1920s. So Turkish army will defend Turkish state tradition for us, people think. But during the coup attempt, people realized that this was not the secular Kemalist military that was staging a coup, but rather a, let's say, anti-Erdogan and also anti-nationalist a segment of military that was staging a coup. Like, it was foreign control. That was the main impression we got. So there was almost no support for it whatsoever.
President Erdogan has blamed the Islamic scholar Fethullah Gulen, who lives in Pennsylvania, for being behind the coup attempt. Gulen has denied that. But as a result, hundreds of thousands of people were rounded up. Were they all followers of Gulen?
Well, according to secular journalists who were imprisoned by Mr. Erdogan in 2000s, it is indeed a great segment of Turkish government that's connected with the Gulen movement. So journalists started exposing these things in 2000s, but Erdogan imprisoned them. And then, after the coup, he started using their books, which shows all the connections in his purges. And I think it's well documented that this is a network that has lots of connections and influence on the Turkish state. And that's how the Turkish state works. You know, different networks compete for power. And seculars were warning against giving too much power to a religious sect. And I think Erdogan learned that he made a mistake in 2000s. And so he decided to undo all the appointments he did. So that's like a massive undo. You press one button and it's a massive undo. And it's like, as you say, thousands and thousands of people who were there, who were put there, mainly because they were part of this network.
I would assume that since some of them were probably important functionaries, that would cause a certain amount of turmoil. People who just simply got things done as part of the normal functioning of the government.
Yeah, I think Turkish state is very weak. It just gives control to one group of people and it expects from them to do everything. Rather than have a proper state tradition where things go smoothly, like clockwork, that's not how things work. You just give all the high positions, all the crucial places to these people, and then once you are not friends with them anymore, what do you do? Like, even the most daily things become a big problem. So they lowered the standards in hiring public servants in order to fill these positions. But there are so many unemployed people, like especially teachers in public schools, that have been asking for appointments. So they'll find teachers, they'll find public servants. Turkey is a big country.
My guest is Kaya Genç. His book, Under the Shadow, Rage and Revolution in Modern Turkey. There were military coups in 1960, 1971, 1980, and what some call a postmodern coup in 1997. How stable has Turkey's democracy been?
It's not a stable democracy. It's politicians always see themselves as under attack. They're very anxious. There are plots against me. What am I going to survive the day? Is my aide going to stab me in the back? And as we see in the latest coup attempt, these fears turn out to be true. So there is no stability in Turkish democracy. And the more politicians want to build a stable democracy, the more they fail because they make these big mistakes. They give too much power to one group. And so the structure of the state is left in the background.
Gulen and Erdogan were allies for a while. And did Gulen go into exile because of those that kind of power struggle that you were just talking about?
He was exiled before the friendship began. So he went to exile before Erdogan's rule, and Erdogan asked him to come back to Turkey so that, you know, he can run his business from Turkey. But Gulen never came back, and this raised suspicions among Turkish seculars and the left, and they started associating Mr. Gulen with Washington rule or like CIA. And so, like, if anyone was working for one of his think tanks, that person would be associated with CIA and foreign meddling with Turkish politics.
Is that likely?
Well, it is suspicious that all the network is based in Washington, and then when he was most friendly with Erdogan, he didn't come back. So, like, he became a symbol of foreign intervention in Turkey, especially among the left. And Turkish nationalists, too, they were asking him to come because Erdogan is always in Istanbul or Ankara. He's always a stone's throw away from you if you're in the power centers. But Gulen is always the man who's far away, who's beyond the Atlantic. So I think that gave him a bad name in Turkey as well.
For this book, you interviewed a range of people, mostly creative types, writers, artists, journalists. What did you hope to find?
I hope to find articulate young people who were passionate about their ideas, and I wanted to create a kind of Rashomon film. You know, there's this event, and there are these different interpretations of the same event. So there is the Gezi event that we all know and experienced in 2013. There was a big public protest in a public park in Istanbul, and young people pitched tents. And then it went on for weeks and weeks, and then the Turkish state brutally suppressed it. So my concern was to see the same event from different perspectives, from the first guy who pitched the tent there, and also the guy who went to Erdogan's, who went to greet Erdogan in an airport to crush these protests. So I was wondering whether if I provided all these perspectives together in the same chapter, how that would look like and what kind of picture that would create.
Were most of the people you interviewed younger?
Yeah, so I wanted to interview people born after 1990, but there are some slightly older ones as well. But I wanted to be the kind of voice of that generation.
And is there a generation gap?
There's a gap because this generation didn't really know how to express themselves. But they like, for example, things like Occupy New York, Occupy Wall Street, Occupy London. They found themselves in these foreign events. But in Turkey, before 2013, that kind of protest culture didn't exist. So they suddenly found the kind of stage on which they could put on their own political play, and that's that they liked a lot.
Istanbul bridges Europe and the Middle East, Asia. How has that influenced life there? Is there a constant flow of people east to west, west to east, and would their opinions be reflected in where they came from?
We have lots of, for example, Syrian refugees right now, more than a million refugees.
Because you border on Syria.
Yeah. So the demography is constantly changing. People are constantly mixing with each other. And Istanbul, I live near Gezi Park in at heart of Istanbul. And that's a place where you can see American culture, Syrian culture, Arabic culture, and local cultures together. And that makes Istanbul very interesting and also, of course, a bit insecure as well, because during the past year, we've seen that there was perhaps too much freedom on the border.
We will talk more about Istanbul and about the border and about ISIS and whatever else we can get to after we take a little break. My guest is Kaya Genç. His book, Under the Shadow, Rage and Revolution in Modern Turkey is published by I.B. Taurus. We're back with Kaya Genç. His book, Under the Shadow, Rage and Revolution in Modern Turkey, is published by I.B. Taurus. Istanbul is by far the largest city in Turkey and one of the largest in the world, isn't it? 14 million people? You write that it was once ruled by Kiev. What does that mean?
Yeah, I think it's still ruled by Kiev.
Yeah. It's hard to know when you see a word written in another language. K-E-Y-I-F?
Yeah. It's a crucial word to understand Istanbul culture. It's the kind of laid-back pleasures of the city that we find in the waterside, in cafes, in the kind of nice little neighborhoods of the city, and a state of carelessness. A state of integration with the present moment, and that's something that we really care about. And Kiev is something that Turkish people are trying to preserve in the city amidst all these political tribulations.
In his book Istanbul, Orhan Pamuk described, quote, frenzy to turn Istanbul into a pale, poor, second-class imitation of a Western city. Has it been changing that much, or was that before the wave of violence?
Modernization has been changing Istanbul a lot, and gentrification is changing it a lot.
Istanbul? What about Ankara and Izmir, the other?
Ankara has its own distinctive republican style. You know, it's already a boring city built by the kind of republican architecture that most people in Istanbul don't like. But Istanbul's beauty is like its ruinous buildings, its old buildings. I live in a building built in 19th century by an Armenian architect. And if the government had the license, I'm sure they would just destroy my building and build like a new boring one instead. So these new buildings are really, they also like skyscrapers and like huge tall buildings. And these are, of course, killing the soul of the city.
Before the wave of terrorism and before the rise of the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, Turkey's population and economy had been growing very rapidly. What changes was that growth bringing to Istanbul and other major cities?
Well, you could see lots of entrepreneurs on the streets, young people, like people from my generation would open like new businesses, develop apps, and we would hear all these young millionaire stories, and there would be lots of new cafes and bookstores and like hipster places. So you could see that it wasn't just the big Turkish companies like Koç and Sabancı. These are like the big conglomerates in the country. Apart from them, a new sort of capitalism emerged, and nowadays, after the terror attacks, we see that these entrepreneurs are silently losing their power and determination.
So the economy is slowing down?
Yeah, that kind of economy is slowing down. And now the old-fashioned mainstream companies are very strong again. So the Koç and Sabancı's are like the places that you want to work for. The big companies that maybe your father or grandfather would like to work, you now have to work for them as well. But for these little companies, little entrepreneurs, it's more difficult.
How do people you interviewed view President Erdogan or the Turkish government in general? Do they distrust Turkish politicians the way many Americans distrust ours?
I think they found out what they think about Erdogan after Gezi. So some young people that I interviewed found in him a source of strength, determination, and power, and the kind of sultan figure that the Ottomans had. So some people see it as a historical failure that the sultan figure disappeared from Turkey's political structure. And so they want to have that kind of figure in the political system. But as for others, They found in him all the kind of patriarchal and figure of authority, the kind of father figure that they want to rebel against. So I think he's being seen as a father figure, and like what you do with a father figure, I think determines your reaction to Erdogan.
Well, often the people with totalitarian leaders present themselves as father figures. But you mentioned Gezi. There were popular demonstrations that erupted in 2013 over the development plans for the area of the Gezi Park and also Taksim Square. Did you witness those protests?
Yeah, I live very close by. It was impossible not to witness. And of course, as a curious person, you go and you see all the tents and all the young people who were determined to spend weeks there. And the weather was nice. It was like festival weather. So it was the place to visit and see. But then, of course, it became a very dangerous place because the police was rumored to come at any moment, and they were expected to throw their tear gas, and so people went there with their masks and with all kind of first aid kits. So that was a festive place, but also a place that you knew you could get into trouble in.
So have the development plans proceeded, or were they halted by the protests?
Well, they were altered, so the government decided to not do anything about the park for a while, and now the roads around it has been pedestrianized, and now Gezi Park is its most beautiful at the moment. Like, it really dominates Taksim Square. Before the protests, there was traffic there, and now it's just a pedestrianized square with Gezi Park, and I think conservatives are also believing that they made the right thing by not destroying the park.
I'm speaking with Kaya Genç, who's a novelist and essayist from Istanbul. He has been published in Paris Review, The Guardian, The Financial Times, London Review of Books, Salon, Guernica Magazine, Sight and Sound, The Millions, The White Review, Time Magazine, among others. His first novel, L'Aventure, was published in 2008. And now this book, Under the Shadow, Rage and Revolution in Modern Turkey, published by I.B. Taurus. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Has there been a general shift to the right, as there has been in much of the rest of Europe?
I wouldn't call it right-wing politics. I would call it maybe nationalist politics or localized politics.
Not conservative religious?
I think religious, I wouldn't call it religious. Erdogan's new line is different, I think. Now he's replaying the Atatürk politics. He's like, foreigners are there to meddle with our affairs. We have to unite against them. We have to build a local solution, a local answer to the foreign threats. And that's something that's been going on since mid-19th century.
But in those days, the enemy was always the Greeks, because there was such a strong Greek presence on the Asia Minor side of the Adriatic, but where Greek civilization actually began to a large degree. But the Greeks aren't there anymore. So who presents the foreign threat? It's the CIA, as you've been saying in the past?
Yes, yeah, CIA and European countries. Mrs. Merkel is one of the suspected ones.
Angela Merkel is a threat to Turkey? In what way?
Yeah, so according to Turkish politicians, Germany and Obama administration wanted a regime change in Turkey because they didn't like Erdogan's new line, because Erdogan was a liberal ideal leader during 2000, you know, pro-EU, pro-West, and he suddenly changed his line, and he became the voice of the local nationalist politicians. And interestingly, that's what the secularists wanted in 2000 when they opposed Erdogan. They wanted him to be a nationalist leader rather than a tool of the foreigners. So when Erdogan did that, I think he won support from Kemalists, the kind of people who support a secular republic. And they're fine as long as Erdogan says Turkish Republic is good, Turkish state is a good place to be, and we don't want to change it under foreign influence. As long as he says that, I think the Kemalists will be okay with him.
But then there is also the Kurdish separatist movement and the presence of a sizable Kurdish population in Turkey. Are the nationalists just opposed to the Kurds totally?
Yeah, so it's interesting in that before Gezi began in 2013, just a few weeks before Gezi began, Erdogan began a Kurdish peace initiative. So people expected that Abdullah Öcalan would be released from prison, the leader of the Kurds, the armed Kurds, let's say. And there would be more local autonomy for Kurds. So there was a plan. There was a peace initiative plan. So some of the people who went to Gezi Park were passionate Turkish nationalists who wanted nothing to do, like no negotiations with Kurdish separatists. So in the past year, Erdogan decided that these peace initiatives won't work. So he now also won the support of these Turkish nationalists. So whatever discourse he's producing, he's getting more votes. It's an interesting phenomenon.
The population is growing faster in eastern Turkey, where the Kurds form a majority. How could that alter the political balance?
Now, not all Kurds hate Erdogan. Most Kurds are conservative in southeastern cities, and the PKK movement, the Kurdish Workers' Party movement, is a secular left-wing movement, and many of the Kurds don't agree with its policies. So there will be a presidential referendum this year, and according to polls, almost like 50% of Kurds can vote for Erdogan's executive presidency. That's the kind of support that he gets from them.
According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, Turkey jailed more journalists than any other country in the last year. On what grounds?
Well, the state has been continuing with this terrible tradition for many years. So the grounds are that, of course, journalists are terrorists, they are conspiring against the government. That's the same line that was used 10 years ago. So all the secular journalists, all the Republican journalists were imprisoned because they were telling the truth. They were saying that, you know, there is something wrong going on in the Turkish state apparatus. The Gulenists are organizing, you know, the state should be, you know, careful about this. But the rulers don't want to hear the truth, you know, because the truths are ugly. And now, for example, journalists are reporting on stories about people in the governing party or in the city administration. And when they don't want to hear these stories, they just lock them up. It's been made so easy because of the state of emergency in Turkey.
And they've closed news outlets and publishing houses as well. Just without justification, or the... are they just saying that they're anti-state?
Some of them have been linked with the Gulen movement. Some because the Gulen movement is a business network. Actually, it's a big business network that owns lots of publishing houses, a huge newspaper and radio station. So, I think the closure of them is one part of the story, but I think the more tragic part of the story is the closure of little leftist papers or like Kurdish journalists. That's a more tragic story.
Now, if a young Western potential jihadist wants to go fight for ISIS or I don't know what the Turks are calling it, Daesh or whatever.
Daesh, yeah.
They will go to Turkey because the border is easy to cross. And there has been a lot of talk about ambivalence and the Turkish ruling rulers as to whether there should be a strong push against Daesh, because of the whole Kurdish complication. So where are things now? Is Turkey providing a fair number of people to the jihad, or what does the general population of Turkey think about this complicated situation?
Well, at the beginning, Turkey was very ambiguous about what it thought about Daesh and the phenomenon of Daesh. And we had under our previous prime minister, Ahmet Davutoğlu, who is a professor of international relations, there was a general sense that the Turks were supporting the Syrian rebels alongside CIA. So they were like sending arms to these groups. And so the border was not policed at all. But then the Turkish army downed a Russian jet, if you remember. And that was also seen as an extension of Turkey's Syria policy. But
now Turkey and Russia are suddenly becoming very friendly.
That changed dramatically last year when Erdogan fired Ahmet Davutoğlu in a very Donald Trump way. He just invited him to his office, and they had a little chat, and Davutoğlu was out of the picture. And then Turkey suddenly became friends with Russia, and so now it became the biggest biggest enemy of Daesh. And if you watch Daesh videos, propaganda videos, they say Erdogan is like Mustafa Kemal. He's like an infidel, and he was an Islamist once, okay, but then he went to the secular side. So they hate him as much as they hate Atatürk.
And what about the Turkish population? Because recently there have been as many terrorist attacks from Daesh as there have been from the Kurds, or maybe even more now.
Yeah, so Turkish people have been very open to Syrian refugees. There were like no racist demonstrations on the streets. People said nothing to immigrants. But about Daesh, they blamed the Turkish state for being too soft on the borders and not questioning who is coming in. And they were right to criticize the Turkish government. And of course, last New Year's Eve, we had the terrible attack in a nightclub that killed dozens in Istanbul. And people expect the Turkish state to do more on arresting these people, because there are a great many of them in Istanbul.
There were some who suggested that the most recent elections were fixed, were rigged. Does that affect the way people see their government?
Well, I think people trust the elections, because one thing that the Turkish state does well, has been doing well in the last 90 years, is elections.
And coups as well.
Yeah, I mean, after they allowed a multi-party state, we really have a good electoral system. And of course, the army wants to, you know, doesn't like that a lot, so tries to get its own control. But I think when you say there's like 60% support for Erdogan's presidency, people don't say, oh, he stole the votes. I think people believe that 60% really support him. But the problem is that they can't change that. You know, they can't change people's minds. So that becomes a problem for them.
And voter turnout in Turkey, I understand, is among the highest in the world. Yeah. Thank you so much for being on our show, Kaya Genç, K-A-Y-A-G-E-N-C. His book, Under the Shadow, Rage and Revolution in Modern Turkey, is published by I.B. Taurus.
They're great being here.